senior UN official says Israel is using hunger as a weapon to kill civilians in Gaza, warning that 25% of Gazans are dying of hunger. And a rights advocacy group says 77 out of 99 journalists who lost their lives in 2023 were killed during the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. Now, the Israeli onslaught on Gaza is in its fifth month now. In their recent or most recent acts of genocide, the regime forces have stormed Nasser Hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis, where thousands of displaced people as well as the sick and injured are taking shelter. Videos show Israeli drones targeting journalists and doctors evacuating Nasser Hospital. Palestinians are being attacked by Israeli forces both inside and outside the hospital as they try to flee the facility. The Palestinian health minister said Israel is repeating the horrific crimes it committed in other hospitals in Gaza, such as the Shifa medical complex. Hamas resistance movement has condemned the Israeli bombing of Nasser Hospital, saying these actions show the genocidal nature of the regime's crimes. The health ministry in Gaza says the overall death toll has now passed 28,660, most of them women and children. There seems to be no let-up in Israel's onslaught on Gaza hospitals. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says the regime's forces have kidnapped 20 of its medical and administrative staff, as well as patients at the Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis. The organization rejected Israel's claims that the abductees were linked to Palestinian resistance groups. It said the regime's allegations were slanders aimed at justifying the Israeli army's attacks on hospitals and medical crews in Gaza. The Red Crescent added that Israel is desperately attempting to justify its war crimes by killing medical staff and bombing and destroying hospitals. Israel has repeatedly targeted Gaza's hospitals in what has been globally condemned as a violation of international law. The regime has also blocked the entry of medical supplies and medicines into the besieged territory. Moti Abu Musabe has been with us earlier from Deir al-Balah to give us more details about the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Let's take a listen.
Israeli occupation forces demanded the entire Palestinian paramedics and the medical staff, in addition to the Palestinian injuries and patients, to crammed inside one building, and they opened the gunfire and they shelled several buildings inside the medical complex. Even the orthopedic building was targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. It's worth mentioning that the Israeli occupation forces are attacking those buildings relentlessly these moments, and they are depriving even the medical staff, in addition to the Palestinian injuries and patients, of their basic humanitarian needs, and they are continuously opening their gunfire towards those people, and they are insulting them and dehumanizing them and mocking them as well. We are talking about another crime committed these moments in the medical Nasser complex. It's the same crime that was committed when the Israeli occupation forces invaded and stormed into a Shifa medical complex, and apparently the Israeli occupation forces still feel immune to any kind of sanctions, to any kind of accountability. So this is actually what encourages the Israeli occupation forces to reiterate their crimes against the Palestinian injuries. The current situation there is still hyper hazardous and catastrophic for the Palestinian people at all levels, and according to multiple eyewitnesses, that the Israeli occupation forces kidnapped and abducted hundreds of the Palestinian evacuees when they ordered them and demanded them to evacuate the hospital. They initiated several checkpoints and arrested and kidnapped a lot of the Palestinian people under the claims that they are fighters and they are wanted for the Israeli occupation.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food says Israel is using hunger as a weapon to harm and kill civilians in the Gaza Strip. Michael Fakhri said 25% of Palestinians in the besieged territory are dying of hunger. He added that the people of Gaza currently make up to 80% of the total persons facing famine or catastrophic hunger worldwide. Fakhri said more than 330,000 children under the age of 5 are at risk of severe malnutrition in Gaza. He noted that Israel prevents the UN or any other relief organization from delivering aid to the territory. He stressed that the world has not witnessed such rapid and complete famine of a civilian population since World War II. The UN rapporteur said his observations show that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Over the past 4 months, relentless Israeli airstrikes and shelling have not only claimed innocent lives but destroyed Gaza's vital infrastructures, including the electricity grid. Many Palestinians have come up with novel ideas to make up for the power shortages. Some Gazans in the southern city of Rafah explained their experiments to cope with the crisis.
We have been staying at home for months because of the total blockade of Gaza and the outbreak of war. No jobs, thus no income, no public electricity, and the generators are running out of fuel. So many people here have invented other methods. Some even turn electricity supply into a business. They have to do that because the family needs income. There are also people who use handheld iron cranks to generate electricity or ride bicycles to drive generators.
For the first 20 days living in this tent, we had no electricity and therefore no lights. During the period, I had been thinking over the way to get electricity. So I went to the scrapyard and took home some fans. I assembled them, connected them to the wires, and put the batteries and lights on the ends. It can be seen as one of my own inventions. Fortunately, my experiment succeeded. At least now people don't need to live in the dark in the tent. I hope to expand the application of this invention so it could generate more electricity and hopefully light up the whole refugee camp.
We set up a charging station mainly for the people who live in tents because they have no place to get power. Dozens of devices can be charged at the same time here, most of which are mobile phones, batteries and radios, so that people can at least hear news and know what is going on. There has been a power outage for more than 100 days since the war began. We have been longing for power, but so far we have not seen it.
The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says it will face a cash crunch from March that will only get worse in the following month. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, warned that its situation will keep deteriorating if the funding that has been suspended by a number of countries does not resume. The UNRWA chief said the organization will hit a negative cash flow from the next month. Israel has accused a number of UNRWA employees of helping Hamas in its October 7 operation. The allegation prompted the regime's Western backers to suspend funding to the UN agency. Now, despite the continuation of the suspensions by some Western countries, Ireland has pledged €20 million to UNRWA.
UNRWA is the backbone of humanitarian efforts in Gaza. It is a lifeline, as we've discussed, for 1.9 million people displaced by Israel's military operations. There is no replacement for UNRWA's work in Gaza. Not just humanitarian, but development and the provision of services such as education and health. And those that claim otherwise are simply not telling the truth. And these claims put the lives of desperate people further at risk. I was deeply concerned that a number of UNRWA's key donors suspended their funding based on allegations against a very small number of staff that have yet to be proven. Our partners in the European Union and elsewhere, including the United States, must urgently rescind this decision and resume funding. Ireland's support remains steadfast, and I'm happy today to announce funding of €20 million for UNRWA for its operations in 2024.
Last year, more journalists lost their lives during the US-Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip than ever before. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 77 out of 99 journalists killed in 2023 died in Gaza, 72 of them being Palestinians. The New York-based committee said in its report that 2023 was the deadliest year for the media in almost a decade, mainly due to the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. The number of journalists killed in that year is the highest since 2015 and shows an increase of nearly 44% on 2022's figures. The committee said journalists in Gaza are bearing witness on the front lines, and their loss will have long-term impacts on journalism both in the region and beyond. The committee had previously slammed persecution of journalists by Israeli forces. It is now investigating whether journalists killed in Gaza were deliberately targeted by Israeli soldiers, which would constitute a war crime. Press TV and several other Iranian media outlets have been once again targeted by censorship on Western social media platforms. This time, X, formerly known as Twitter, has removed their blue and gold checkmarks. In addition to Press TV, Iran's Arabic and Spanish language Al Alam and Hispan TV news channels and some Persian language outlets have been also targeted. A number of Russian outlets, as well as those belonging to Yemen's Ansarullah and Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movements, have also been affected. The move came after a report by the Tech Transparency Project, a non-profit watchdog group, alleged that X is providing premium and paid services to individuals and groups sanctioned by the US government. Netizens have accused X of having taken the step under pressure from the pro-Israeli lobby. Nearly all the targeted outlets are critical of Israel and its genocidal war on Gaza. The owner of X, Elon Musk, had recently visited the Israeli-occupied territories, expressing his support for the regime's onslaught on Gaza. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has slammed the US's unflinching support for the Israeli regime in its genocidal war on Gaza.
For the scale of the destruction and killing and criminality to be at this level and to continue for this time while we're in the fifth month in week number 19, all of this goes back to the American participation and the American open support. The Americans, given what they share with them and the support they provide, they are primarily responsible for the destruction and criminality to be at this level or of this scale and to continue for all this time.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the large-scale destructions and killings exceed Israel's capability and reflect the full military support of the regime's allies, especially Washington. He said the U.S. has played a pivotal role in the genocide in Gaza by providing Israel with over 25,000 tons of munitions to kill the Palestinian people. He noted that the explosives used by Israel to hit the besieged strip equals four times the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Al-Houthi said the aim of such unprecedented military operations is to render the coastal territory uninhabitable. Al-Houthi also called on Arab and Islamic nations to take a strong stance against Israel's plan to invade Gaza's southern city of Rafah. Yemen's army says it has carried out another operation targeting a British ship sailing in the Gulf of Aden. Yahya Sari, the spokesperson for the Yemeni armed forces, said the operation was carried out with appropriate naval missiles and the strikes were direct. He added that the operation was in solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The spokesperson reiterated that the Yemeni armed forces persist with their military operations in the Red and the Arabian Seas until Israel ends its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. He also called on all Arab and Islamic nations to take practical positions in support of Palestinians. Sari said Yemen's operations against the US and UK's vessels are legitimate measures and in defense of the country. The US and UK's navies have repeatedly struck Yemen in recent weeks. In our news review program, we have discussed Yemen's operations in solidarity with Palestinians in face of the unswerving US support for Israel and its genocidal war in the Gaza Strip.
We have Hossein Abdulkhaiti, who is an activist and political commentator, joining us from Sana'a. We also have Sakina Datu, who's a journalist, author, and producer, who also joins us. Welcome to you both. Why is it okay for the U.S. to provide Israel with arms and munitions to the amount and to the strength that it has, but it's not okay for, based on their point of view, for Yemen's army to target Israeli-bound U.S. and U.K. vessels that are aiding and trying to have the continuity of the genocidal war?
So first of all, I mean, it is not okay for United States to be supplying that amount of ammunition to Israel. But what is their justification? Their justification is basically non-existent. This is the hypocrisy that the U.S. has been advocating for really forever. I mean, if you look into the history of the United States, this is something that they have been doing for ages. What is different this time is I think they did not account for the fact that this time everybody is watching every move live on their television stations, and because of the social media we know so much. Common people understand this equation so well, and the double standards of the US has been laid for the entire world to see. So there is really no justification in terms of why they continue to provide that amount of weapons. There are different reasons, of course. We know one of the reasons is because they want to make Gaza inhabitable, and this is because they have ambitions in the region. They do want to create, along with Israel, alternative trade routes. But apart from that, also, arms is a big business in the U.S. It increases the economy. It helps the economy of the U.S. Sometimes they are using these weapons upon people of Palestine just as if they were guinea pigs. So they are doing their trials over there. So none of these reasons, of course, are holy. Forget about them being holy. They are totally against human rights of every nature. And yet, of course, here is America preaching constantly to the entire world about values of human rights.
All right. Also, Bukhaiti, another point that is made that's quite important, I believe, by Abdul Malik al-Houthi is this making Gaza uninhabitable, which is a goal of what appears to be the Israeli regime forces. If the U.S. is providing them with the arms and the regime forces are executing that with that goal in mind, doesn't that make the U.S. also have that goal in mind in assisting Israel with it?
Yeah, I mean, of course, from the beginning of the attack on Gaza, it was the U.S. green light that was given to the Israeli. And as well, even though, despite the fact that the United States is speaking about a two-state solution and calling for the Israeli, like, not or like to avoid civilian casualty, I believe that the United States has actually given the green light for Israel to continue its war, especially to continue attack Rafah. Let me make it clear. If it was not thanks to the United States, Israeli will not be able to continue in a war for more than 3 months. It's because of the full support, in not only regarding weapons, but as well political support and as well blocking any resolution in the UN Security Council. I mean, that's why Sayyid Abdul Malik have said that Yemen has taken that step and their operation in the Red Sea, which he said have actually have a great influence on the United States and United Kingdom present in the region.
Thank you for that, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator. Sakina Datu, journalist and author and podcaster there from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Leaders meeting with senior commanders and personnel of the Air Force and Army's Air Defence Force. On Monday, 5th of February 2024, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a large number of commanders and personnel of the Iranian Air Force. The meeting took place in Tehran at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya. In this program, we discuss the leader's remarks and points of views expressed at this meeting. Stay with us. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a large number of commanders and personnel of the Iranian Air Force on Monday, 5th of February. This meeting takes place every year on or near 8th of February. On this day, in 1979, a group of Iranian Air Force officers pledged their allegiance to the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and joined the Islamic Revolution. Commemorating this amazing event, which gave further impetus to the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the events of 9th and 10th of February 1979, when the Shah's Imperial Guard attacked the training center of the Air Force and encountered some resistance from Air Force personnel. And more importantly, the weapons storage facilities were opened up and weapons were distributed among the public, and young revolutionaries became armed for the first time. The following day, on 11th of February 1979, the Shah's regime collapsed and the young revolutionaries, aided by the brave officers and personnel of the Iranian Air Force, succeeded in bringing down the Pahlavi regime. According to the leader, Air Force personnel injected hope and courage into the general public and dashed the hopes of the anti-revolutionaries when they ditched the Pahlavi regime in favour of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Khamenei added, the Air Force took the lead in joining the revolution. Of course, the army, which was an upright, popular, Muslim and faithful body, easily joined the revolution, but the Air Force was in the vanguard. They initially brought about the extraordinary incident by pledging their allegiance to the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, on 8th of February 1979. It is also important to note that after this initial step, about 5 or 6 months later, the self-sufficiency jihad was established. The first branch of the armed forces in which the self-sufficiency jihad organization was formed was the Air Force. This is the same spirit of taking action, that is, the same spirit that leads an active member of the Shah's army towards freeing themselves and joining the Islamic Revolution. The state of courage, spirituality, and spiritual ability and spiritual strength, the same spirit later extends into the field of construction, resulting in the formation of the self-sufficiency jihad. The first place in which the self-sufficiency jihad was established was in the Air Force, and this was a momentous event. It was a great step for the Air Force to think about making their own equipment, manufacturing their own parts, repairing damaged parts, unraveling the secrets behind the complex American technology, which they were not previously allowed to do, and in short, taking action. That was a huge step to take. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei added, before this major step, the Shah's Air Force belonged entirely to the Americans. The fighter aircraft and other military equipment in the Air Force belonged to the Americans. It was a property of the United States, even though Iran had purchased the equipment and paid for it. Well, the faithful elements of the Air Force changed it from being American to being Iranian. The Air Force was Iranianized. It became Iranian. Its commanders became Iranian. Its personnel became Iranian. Its decision-makers became Iranian, and its equipment became Iranian. Although the equipment was made in America, but it belonged to the Iranian people. They did not dare touch it anymore. The Air Force was the catalyst of the Islamic Revolution. The Air Force, in a unique circumstance, became the catalyst of the Islamic Revolution's victory, and the catalyst for breaking the reliance of the Air Force and the army on others. In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, major purposeful movements often slow down and suffer from a slump as they evolve. Even though they do not stop, they experience a state of sluggishness and lethargy. That is the nature of major movements. When you look at the numerous revolutions that have taken place across the world, you will see that a revolution that initially takes place with the intention of bringing about a fundamental transformation However, after a few years, the same circumstances that existed before the revolution resurface once again. This is how it is. In other words, social movements often slow down, they often stop altogether or regress. If a revolutionary movement is to continue on its path, it requires a catalyst. Commenting further, the leader said, "Of course, there is a fundamental difference in the Islamic Revolution that differentiates it from other revolutions. The Islamic Revolution has some things within itself that are appealing to the masses and attracts followers. Even if some individuals decide to abandon the Islamic Revolution, many more individuals join the revolution and thus compensate for those who have parted ways. In the Islamic Republic, we are actively battling against oppression. There is the fight against oppression and standing against the coercion of the world-class bullies. We have the Jamkaran Mosque, the Ihya or Vigil Nights, the Arba'een Walk, and the I'tikaf during the month of Rajab. Note the extensive range of activities. There is both a battle against oppression and a battle against the carnal self. There is a focus on the future of the country as well as attention towards God, spirituality, and God's remembrance, or zikr, paradise, etc. This itself attracts followers to compensate for those who have parted ways." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Therefore, a catalyst is needed. But what is the purpose of this catalyst? It is to prevent the slowing down of actions, to counteract fear, to avoid experiencing incompetence and inferiority in the operational group when a great task is about to be undertaken. This is where the role of the catalyst comes into play. So who is the catalyst and what do they do? We refer to these catalysts as the elite within society. But who are the elite? Are they well-known individuals, educated people or scientists, for example? No. The elite refers to a group of people who make decisions based on their own thinking and knowledge, rather than blindly following others. These people are regarded as the elite. These elites can be among various revolutionaries, business people, workers, military personnel, clerics, and various other groups. They can be among those who work in the media, students, or politicians." Ayatollah Khamenei added, "Fortunately, in our country, the elite are not in a minority. Those who think, make decisions and take appropriate action based on a plan are many, and this is a blessing of the Islamic Revolution. This is not the case in many countries around the world. Now, I have not been there myself, but there are reports from some big and famous countries in the world that the general public are not aware of what is going on in the world around them. What they're concerned about is simply to earn a bit of money or add a bit to their wealth. This is not the case in our country. In our country, people who act with foresight, discernment, understand what they're doing, recognize the fronts, recognize the enemy, know their methods, and recognize who their friends are not few in number. They are numerous. These people can play an active role. They can undertake tasks for the country in critical cases. They have a heavy responsibility. What I would like to tell you is that those who have ideas, their views are thoughtful and discerning. They understand and recognize different situations. They know what is going on and refrain from blindly following others. They have heavy responsibilities. They need to maintain the general direction of the movement of society and not allow this movement to deviate. If elite members of society neglect their duty, the repercussions that follow will strike historic blows to the nation. We have experienced many incidents like this in the past, in the history of Islam. During the era of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace be upon them, there were people among the elite who correctly understood and identified the issues, but were not present when their involvement was needed. These individuals were doubtful, indecisive, lazy, and sometimes even treacherous. Their negative impact spread to others, including those who blindly followed the majority. Commenting more on the elite, the leader said, "The enemy front has devised a special plan targeting the elite. They have plans for the elite in our country and in many other countries in the world. They seek to create doubts, hesitation, and indecisiveness in the elite. They seek to lure them with worldly pleasures to attract them so that they do not take decisive action at critical moments. This is something which is expected of the elite. The duty of the elite is to counteract the enemy's attempts to sow doubt and to clarify matters when necessary. The jihad of clarification is based on this." Commenting on the situation in the Gaza Strip, the leader said, "If I were to give an example regarding the elite in our present time, I believe it would be the situation in the Gaza Strip. The elite in the Islamic world have certain duties. The elite are scholars, scientists, politicians and journalists. They see what is happening in the Gaza Strip. They realize how the United States, with the support of the Zionist regime, is hurting humanity. They're aware of this. They should talk to their own people and explain the situation in order to persuade them. The elite need to create a public demand amongst the people so that their governments will have no choice but to strike at the Zionist regime. Certainly, the elite can cut off economic relations with the Israeli regime. This is something that they should really ought to consider. If people around the world demand this from their governments and put pressure on them, this will happen, and it will be effective. Nations can compel their governments to withdraw their backing from the cruel Zionist regime, which is killing women and children and the elderly in Gaza." In concluding remarks, the leader said, "May the Lord suppress this nation's enemies, and may the Iranian nation emerge victorious. God's greetings, mercy and blessings upon all of you."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Dear ladies from all around the world, welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma. You're listening to Arab English Radio, and I'm honored to be your host. Here with us, we have Brother Mustafa, who is going to help us know more about issues related to Muslim ladies.
Right.
Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me. Really happy to be here to speak about, you know, these topics. Definitely it's, you know, a bit of a surprise or a shock to be invited to talk about this topic, considering I'm a man. However, I am studying psychology in the Hawza. You know, I'm married with kids, so I have a lot of experience, I would say, that I can hopefully share and give maybe an insight or perspective from the outside.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So, as we can see right now in today's life, there are a lot of things that are going differently if we are going to compare them with the past. And one of those things is the appearance of the society. It has been changed totally. The way women and men are going to define themselves has been changed. And there are a lot of reasons for that. So if we want to put a label for today's discussion, we're going to put it this way, that what are the challenges a woman, a lady, would face in today's world?
Yeah, I think today's world is a very, very difficult place, you know, for anyone, especially for women, I would say, and mothers. A lot of that, of course, has to do with, for example, the westernization of the world, right?
Or, yeah.
And part of that is, of course, this feminist movement, right? That's really changed how women perceive themselves, mm-hmm. right? You know, from a psychological point of view, when we talk about this, we say that someone's understanding of a certain topic, you know, their how they perceive that topic is really important. If they have the wrong perception about any topic, then they're going to, you know, maybe not interact with that, you know, in a better way. To give you sort of an example of what I mean, what I'm talking about is someone's attitude, right? An attitude towards something is made up of three components, right? Mm-hmm. One is their sort of understanding of that. I'll take something very simple. Let's say it's a snake, right? So what you understand from a snake, you understand it's an animal, for example, that is dangerous.
It's poisonous.
It's poisonous. And then to that, you have an emotional reaction to that, mm-hmm. right? And once you have it could be fear, it could be curiosity. Some people love snakes, right?
Yeah.
And that then impacts your behavior, right? So these three components are important. And I would say the attitude that's given towards mothers and women, that's really changed, right? People don't necessarily recognize how important that is. For example, women are defined as a working person, you know, just like a man, for example. So if you get that perception in your mind and you have that emotional reaction, that's going to change your behavior.
Exactly. Now, we have it that in literature, we call it ideology. As we go through critical concepts, we call that ideology. Society usually creates ideology based on their benefit, their own right. benefit. They're going to create a special ideology, and then they would impose it on the mind of other people. So what happens is that, just like the way that you mentioned, if I am settled with this idea that a woman is as equal as a man in her abilities, in her power, let's say, not abilities, because all the women out there are so creative, they have a lot of abilities and talents, but you don't necessarily have to get outside the I don't want to say home, because even there are women who are working outside and they're making a balance between what, right. what they're doing outside and what the responsibilities they have at home. But I'm just saying that when society tells you that you must work as a laborer just like a man, and you come to believe it, then everything is going to be changed.
And you know, that causes like the family unit to be destroyed, right?
Yeah.
When the mother isn't playing her role, for example, to the best extent possible, then that's going to have an impact on the family.
And right? that's why we get to individualism. Now people tend to be living all alone.
Right. And one thing that I learned recently, you know, that compared to the past and to now, for example, the way advertisements and the media works, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess this is the best time for us to go for a short break, a change of mood, and then we'll be back to see what's going on. Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady, and we're talking about the challenges a woman would face in today's life, which is very difficult world. We already mentioned some points related to ideology and how society is going to impose its own ideology and its own way of thinking upon the minds of the individuals in society, and how if you accept that, okay, a woman is equal to a man, though she's not because she's more delicate, she does not have that much of power to go for difficult jobs. Yet, if you believe it, then you're going to accept all the social norms that are so prevailing right now. And then, at the same time, society would go through the pathway of individualism. That is, nobody would like to interact with other people. All that matters is that I am living alone, doing my own job, and I'm a social being.
Yeah, and like that. To be honest, that sounds kind of depressing. And
a lot. That's very.
And I
depressing.
Know people or examples of, you know, people that are living in different countries that they're living that life. You know, they're living alone, and they're not very happy many times. You know, especially as they start aging. You know, I once met a relative of ours that lives in Australia, and you know, she lives by herself. She's probably in her 60s now.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
And. Like, she doesn't have an easy life, I would say.
Of course.
She has a difficult life. And before we went for the break, you know, one of the things that I wanted to mention is that the critical role that today's media plays in this, one of our teachers was explaining this. He was saying that in the past, you know, you didn't have as much advertisement. You didn't have as much, like, you know, means of getting information.
Commercials.
And not only that, like, let's say we didn't have like individual phones, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Right now, whatever I'm viewing right now in this room, you know, on my phone, for example, you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
Right? So the channel that we're getting information from becomes secret. It's anonymous from like the other family members. So you find this example in one home, there's going to be like five people, and all five people have different ideologies because of how they're using media and what they're looking up. And
five separate worlds.
It's five separate worlds, right? And that has a huge impact on how women perceive their role as mothers or
exactly.
what their role in society is. And that's what's really causing challenges.
You say as a mother, I would say as a woman. As a woman, it has been changed, much less a mother.
Right. Right. The focus has been, and the other thing that our teacher was mentioning that unfortunately, women and ladies, they're used as tools for
exactly.
advertisements, right? They're used as a tool, not as, like, they're not seen as, like, the final, when you're trying to sell a product, right? You're trying to sell a product to people, right? And they're saying they're using women as a tool to sell products.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. To convince people.
To convince people that, or, you know, to attract people to come and buy that product.
It's actually very paradoxical. Even all these movements that are talking about the rights of women, even the feminists, they all try to talk of women's rights, but what they come up with is actually against women.
Right. And, you know, one of the challenges that occurs in this is that then a woman feels that her role as a mother is not as important.
Exactly.
Right? They lose sight or value of that goal, and they might be, you know, going after, for example, fashion, trying to go after look.
She must be a beautiful doll, and if she has a lot of money, then that would be a perfect lifestyle.
Right.
Then that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it could be so much more. And, you know, women start feeling insecure about their appearance, right? How they look. And for example, one result of that we're seeing is, for example, plastic surgery.
Yeah.
Right? People are going crazy over there. They're like fixing their nose, their face, their, you know.
Everything.
Yeah. And that is not natural. That is not like something that, you know, that nature, you'll find in nature. We're the only species, you know, that goes out and changes their appearance.
Yeah.
And it's mostly just a lot of times cosmetic, right? Just
exactly.
to look good.
So now that you have studied psychology, what are the reasons for that? For that excessive appeal for plastic surgery and changing your nature, your appearance.
So that is part of, in my opinion, is part of psychological warfare, right?
Yeah.
Psychology as a field of study is unfortunately not always used positively. In fact, what you'll find is a lot of the psychological research was done by, for example, the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. You know, so how can they? And from that, we find, for example, many tools and ways that they use to manipulate and control people. In order to sort of weaken society and to weaken the role of a woman, they're using psychological tactics like I talked about advertisement and, you know,
oh,
media.
Yeah. Yes.
So those are all channels to sort of to change your the way you're thinking.
Mentality.
Change your
to
mentality.
Change the
your
values. Yeah.
Change your attitude. Once you change the attitude towards something and you get that emotional reaction out of someone, it's very easy to change their behavior.
Yeah. Well, I guess right now we have to go for a break and then we'd come back with the last part of today's episode.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So you were just saying that psychology has been used sometimes as a tool against human beings, and especially since we're talking to ladies, against ladies and how they think and change their values and whatsoever. So how we could fight that back?
So the way to fight that back is to correct your attitude, is to correct your understanding of yourself and your relationship with the world.
You have to filter it, I guess, through your values, through your religious norms.
The, you know, the other thing that I think media does is even they portray that from an Islamic point of view, they portray as if Islam is oppressing women, right? You hear that all the time in like in Western media.
While on the contrary, Islam is actually being the religion who's been giving yeah. women the freedom, who's been giving women I mean, the values.
It's funny that before, you know, I'm living here in Iran and, you know, when I go to like other countries, especially like to like where there's like Western like audiences, they always think that women in Iran are so oppressed, you know,
yeah.
like they don't have freedom. I tell them there's more women working here than there are probably men. You know, there women have way more respect here and way more power here than I would say men have, right? I don't think this is the right thing, but you'll see that right now these days, even you have female drivers, you know, that
yes.
are picking and
actually,
dropping.
It's good for the safety of women, you know.
It is, but I'm saying I've been like picked up through like, you know, the
yeah,
Snap type
yeah.
services by women as well. So
that's how much freedom they have.
That's how much freedom and lack of oppression they have here, you know. In every
yeah.
bank, in every shop, everywhere mm-hmm. you go, you'll find that, you know, women are part of the workforce here.
And speaking of religion, I would say that in the Holy Book of Quran, we have a chapter devoted to women. That means all the important matters of women do matter in our religion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, our religion, the way Islam honors a woman and a lady and a mother, for example, it's you will not find it in any other religion or ideology,
mm-hmm.
right? In fact, we find that many times people that convert to Islam, any woman that converted, is because of this reason.
Exactly. So just to wrap it all up, we would say that there are a lot of challenges that a woman must face in today's world, but the only solution to it is just to revert those psychological tools that you say that are being used in order to change the mentality of women is to think.
It's to think, it's to ponder, and I would say, you know, stop watching like nonsense serials and dramas which
oh.
fill your mind with like rubbish notions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the other tools, by the way, right?
Okay. And thank you, brother. And thank you, dear listeners, dear ladies, for staying with us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. We'll be right back.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
The limelight.
Under an opaque policy condemned as discriminatory and inhumane, the British government has refused dozens of visas for children of migrant single mothers. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. An investigation revealed Britain's Home Office is systematically barring young children from joining their mothers in Britain, despite extensive proof that the women are their primary caregivers. Under an opaque policy condemned as discriminatory and inhumane, the British government has refused dozens of visas for children of migrant single mothers, many of whom came to work in the National Health Service or social care, saying there are no compelling reasons to grant them a visa. The women left their children, some as young as 2 years old, in the temporary care of relatives or friends, while they moved to Britain from countries like Zimbabwe, Zambia, Kenya, South Africa, and India. They say before leaving their country, they had been reassured by their employers that their children would be able to follow them to Britain, in line with current immigration rules, permitting healthcare workers to bring close family members to Britain. But when they applied for their children's visas, their applications were turned down. In refusal letters seen by The Guardian, the Home Office questioned why the children could not stay permanently with their grandparents or other relatives. In other cases, it said there was no reason why they could not go to live with their fathers, even though their mothers had sole custody or their fathers had not seen the children for years. Many of the letters addressed directly to the children conclude, "It was your mother's personal decision to depart for the United Kingdom, and you have not provided sufficient evidence to grant your visa on serious or compelling grounds." The cases have come to light weeks after the government announced a plan to slash immigration by placing restrictions on the dependents of migrants' healthcare workers. Under controversial rules expected to be introduced this spring, care workers coming to the United Kingdom will be barred from bringing their family members to Britain, while other healthcare workers will have to earn £29,000 a year, rising to £38,700 a year in 2025 to be permitted to do so. But scores of applications from such workers are already being quietly refused. The Guardian has examined 10 cases and been alerted to 140 more, where migrant women, all single mothers, have had visas for children denied in the past 18 months. The applications for visas have not been rejected because the Home Office doubts they are genuine or that the women are the children's primary caregivers, Instead, they have been refused under a Home Office rule that a child may only be given a visa if both parents are living in the United Kingdom, unless the parent living in England has sole responsibility. The policy means single parents are required to prove not only that they have sole custody, but that the other parent is not involved in their child's upbringing, something experts say can be hard to do. If the sole responsibility threshold is not met, the Home Office can still grant applications if it believes there are compelling or compassionate grounds for doing so. But as yet, it has declined to do so in the women's cases investigated by The Guardian, which has seen extensive evidence to support the mothers' claims that they are their children's sole caregivers. In many cases, the women gave the Home Office court documents and custody papers proving they were the sole custodian of the child, as well as bank statements, insurance policies, photographs and letters of support from schools, doctors and church leaders. Many also have signed consent letters from their children's fathers, but in some cases this has been used against them. One mother, Yeti, had a visa for her 6-year-old daughter denied. The care worker from Zambia says she and the girl's father separated when she was pregnant, and she has always been her sole caregiver. Shortly after she arrived in Britain in March, Getty, 36 years old, submitted an application for a child to join her. She supplied documents including a court order linked to her separation and an affidavit from the girl's father saying it would be in the child's best interest to come to Britain. But the Home Office refused the child a visa, saying the fact that her father had provided a consent letter was proof he was still in her life and could therefore look after her. Getty said the separation had taken a huge toll, adding, "My daughter asks me every day when her papers are going to be ready. I have to be honest with her and tell her I'm still waiting for the papers. She's only used to living with me. It's really, really hard." In another case, a National Health Service nurse who provided the Home Office with a court document proving she had sole custody for her two daughters, aged 4 and 13, was told there were no serious or compelling reasons why the girls needed to join her in Britain. She said, "It's heartbreaking. How can I sleep at night? I am the mother of the children and I have always looked after them."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines: the Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli forces have kidnapped nearly two dozen of its medical staff and patients.